Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. And for those of you that listen regularly, we took a bit of a hiatus over the holidays, combination of ending the semester and beginning the new one and the holidays and, you know, various factors. So we've been out of the loop for a while, but we're now back in the saddle here at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be joined today by two guests, Professor Darren Shaw, who has slotted us in between classes today on what is the fourth class day of the semester? Is that where we are? We started
That's
Monday?
Right. That's right. Tuesday, Thursday.
Your big days, baby.
11 o'clock to 12:30, 2 to 3:30. That's me.
And here he is, just still popping, right, in between classes.
That's right. Fresh off my appearance at Jerry World, where I saw 1 yard, Jim and Josh, 1 yard, and we'd have been in the championship game.
Well,
tough. I'm still hurting.
We'll come back.
I'm glad that you're here and you have lots of work to do to salve those wounds.
Yeah.
Lots of teaching work. And of course, Josh Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project. Josh, welcome back.
Hey, I was going to say out of the studio, but never out of the loop.
Yeah, it's not like we haven't been talking.
We just
welcome back.
We just took a little break.
We took a little break.
Because otherwise, there would be no break.
And I think one of the things, hopefully, that we'll illustrate today is that, you know, we weren't doing nothing. To that point, today, the agenda is to talk over highlights of the University of Texas, Texas Politics Project poll that we conducted in mid-December. Now, that raises a couple of questions for at least some of you. Some of you, I probably overthink this, but I was referring to this as kind of old, and my wife was like, it's not old.
Well, no, it's funny. I mean, you're saying that. I just looked at my watch to look at it. It's the 16th. I was like, you know what? I mean, we were in the field less than a month ago.
Yeah.
So it's not really. It just feels old. Right. We like to get it out.
As we'll talk about, you know, the poll was in the field from the 9th to the 17th. We didn't get to the data till the 19th or the 20th, which is still pretty fast turnaround. But nonetheless,
we're not going to release it on Christmas.
You know, we weren't going to release it on, you know, the Friday before Christmas. That just seemed silly. And so here we are. Now, for our regular listeners, I should say, obviously the timing is a little odd. We're going to talk about the poll. We're going to probably focus mostly on national stuff. Timing's a little odd given that the big percolating story in Texas politics since the election, and that is the selection of Dustin Burroughs as the new Speaker of the Texas House, just happened yesterday as we're recording this Thursday morning. There's going to be plenty of time to kick this around as the session unfolds. We may even touch on it as things unfold here in terms of, I suspect, talking about Republican coalitional politics at both the national and the state level.
About wasting a question on Phelan in the poll.
Right. Yeah, there you go. You know, the next big foreseeable event on that front is the debate over House rules next week. You know, and I would just, you know, take host privilege and say there's still a lot percolating in the House. It doesn't seem like we have a speaker, but, you know, it's like people are putting on their back mic shoes, I think, for the coming session. And if those of you who follow the legislature know what I mean. So we'll be back to talk about this to the extent that we don't really air it out completely this week. And we'll probably know more by the time we do next week's podcast. So with that all there today, let's start, I think, guys, by talking about what the December poll found when it comes to the big shift in national politics. We have a battery of questions, I think, that in many ways were one of the hearts of this poll, at least at the national level. And these were questions about potential priorities of the new Republican-led government in Washington. So, Josh, why don't you set us up for that, talk about the structure of the questions and the top-line results we got, the basics.
Sure. So we did this with two overall questions. One's a battery and then one's a follow-up. So the battery asks, you know, how much priority should the Trump administration put on developing policies and plans to try to? And then there were 11 different sort of policy areas, and they range. And I may as well say what they are because there's a little bit of, you know, art to this. So lower the prices of goods and services, deport immigrants who are in the U.S. illegally, cut taxes for large businesses, cut taxes for individual taxpayers, increase tariffs on imported goods, end government diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, limit USAID to foreign allies, reduce the size of the federal government, strengthen national defense, and reduce the flow of fentanyl into the country. Overall, so the respondents had a choice of saying it should be a very high priority, a medium priority, a low priority, or not a priority. And partially that scale is big so we can get some variance and really, in some ways, force people to at least, you know, tell us what they really think matters. And then we followed that up and we said, well, okay, of all these, what should be the top priority? And that allows us to both get a sense of what is sort of the rank order first priority, but also we can see them in comparison to each other. Overall, unsurprisingly, given all the polling we've done, lowering the prices of goods and services was the only item that's received a majority of Texas voters saying this should be a very high priority of the Trump's administration, so 54%. Notably, increasing tariffs on, you know, imported goods, 12% said that should be a very high priority, 11% said it should be a very high priority to cut taxes for large businesses. Huge differences here, obviously, by partisanship. Unsurprisingly, most of these policies are much more attractive to Republicans than to Democrats. Only lowering the prices of goods and services saw a majority of Democrats saying this should be a very high priority, whereas for Republicans, there were four issues where a majority of Texas Republican voters said that should be a very high priority of the administration. The number one was reducing the flow of fentanyl into the country, 60%, so that should be a very high priority. About the same, strengthening the national defense, 59%, lowering prices, 56%, and deporting immigrants who are in the U.S. illegally, 55%, so about the same as lowering prices. When we asked what is the number one issue that they should focus on, for all voters, the plurality, 34%, said lowering the prices of goods and services. About 1 in 5, 19% said deporting immigrants who are in the U.S. illegally, with 1 in 10 saying cut taxes for individual taxpayers. For Democrats, lowering prices was clearly the number one priority, 45%, followed at a pretty distant second by cutting taxes for individual taxpayers at 17%, which is interesting and notable in some ways, and come back to that. Republicans were split. The plurality said they think that the Trump administration should focus on deporting undocumented immigrants, 32%, with 25% saying they should focus on lowering prices. So 57% of Republican voters in total said that should be, those two things should be the top priorities, whereas most of the other things were around 10% or significantly less.
So what do you make of this there? And I there was something I was going to flag on this, but I've lost the thought. But so what do you make of this, Darren? I mean, I'm specifically interested. I mean, as we were in our, to pull back the curtain in our internal discussions, you, I think, very productively, reminded that we needed to put the reducing spending items that are in this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious kind of what you made of the results.
Well, I think if I'm looking at this from the perspective of the Trump administration, there's four obvious choices for emphasis. Lowering prices of goods and services, strengthening national defense, cutting taxes for taxpayers, individual taxpayers, and then reducing the flow of fentanyl. The fifth is immigration, which I think is almost equally obvious, but with an asterisk or with a caveat. And when I say obvious, you know, Josh mentioned these, you know, very high priority ratings. If you combine high and very high, the top four items, 71% or above, identify them as a high priority or a very high priority. So that's, you know, getting prices under control, reducing fentanyl, strengthening defense, cutting taxes. Those four things have at least 70% support. The next highest rating is when you move to immigration, goes to 56% or 53%, I think. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge gap between those four and everything else. And it's manifest in the next question. We said, which is all right. We've asked about all these things. What are the top priorities? And you get prices, deporting immigrants here illegally, cutting taxes, strengthening national defense. Four things. Now, the fentanyl is, you know, on that top priority list is a little lower, but, you know, so there's four or five things. The immigration thing looks a little trickier because when you start talking about deporting people who are here illegally, you know, the way we framed it, which I think is right, but just so everybody knows, we say deport immigrants who are in the United States illegally. We didn't say illegal immigrants, immigrants who are here illegally. And that's where you begin to get a small clutch of voters, especially Democrats, who are opposed to that. Now, if you frame that deporting, as the Trump administration said it's going to do, people who have already been denied asylum claims or who have been charged with a crime here in the United States. My sense is, now that's not a priority, that's a policy question, but in terms of a priority, I think that would ratchet it up quite a bit. So I look at this and I'm thinking, you know, if you're talking about tariffs or if you're talking about, you know, cuts to business, you know, corporate tax cuts, you know, limiting foreign aid, people don't care.
Yeah.
You got a pretty obvious agenda that you need to pursue. And I would actually be fairly optimistic if I were in the Trump administration looking across it. I think you can cut deals on most of these items, which, you know, gets to one thing to say people want something done. The other is, can you actually do it? The trickiest one, of course, is actually getting prices under control.
Well, that's what I wanted to follow up on, because and I confused two different questions here in terms of what, you know, the discussion that you sort of inserted the debt stuff on. But this leads to that. And, we can come back to this list. But if you look at the economic components in the question about, you know, where people are concerns are in the economy, I think it underlines how difficult it is to actually attack that price thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. You know, people want to spend money to solve problems.
Yes.
And so what the impulse here would be is to say, like, okay, well, you need to pump more money into the economy to address certain problems, except
really drives prices up.
That's
when
a
you
problem.
Do that.
Yeah. And it's the same with tariffs,
right,
obviously, too, which is a couple of things you've committed to are probably going to be inflationary. And, you know, I don't even know what, you know, the president has, as we all know, a relatively limited toolkit when it comes to dealing with inflation. This is a problem that goes back to Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
You know, what do you do? You're dependent on the Fed, and even the Fed has limited tools, and the Fed is obviously insulated from the president with respect to, you know, what the Fed is going to do. The president can only sort of suggest and then hope the Fed takes their
advice. Or complain.
Yeah, or complain. So, you know, while I'm convinced that the sort of pathway is obvious, the execution of that pathway, especially on the prices, is really going to be tricky. Especially as Jimmy pointed out, that there are some contradictory impulses here, right? The public wants you to spend money on some things, but that could exacerbate inflation.
Well, and some of them are
contradictory. And the deficit, which is
they're contradictory within Trump's own
kind
of program. And as we're seeing as the Congress shapes up, particularly the U.S. House, you know, not everybody shares the president's theory of economics,
right?
Including some prominent people from Texas.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is all really, I mean, what's really interesting about this data is on some, I was saying, you know, again, before we were talking about this, and in some sense, you know, there's ways to read this data and kind of just see what you want, depending on, you know, again, how you want to interpret this. And I think there's a certain sense that if you kind of look at the top lines with a quick glance, I think it's easy to look at the Trump administration and also Republicans in Texas and think, boy, you know, you've got a pretty hefty meal on your plate, right? In the sense of like, you know, if you look at what people say that they're worried about here, and it's like, you know, the mixture of delivering on prices, on housing, on, you know, sort of increasing concerns and dissatisfaction with healthcare, which is kind of floating around out there, while also, you know, potentially deporting, you know, millions and millions of people. You know, it's like, well, I mean, you're right. Like, I agree with Darren. Like, on the one hand, it's sort of straightforward in that there's clearly areas of some consensus. And you can see, I mean, what's interesting in some of this data, going back to the priority piece, for instance, just looking at, you know, for Democrats, for instance, on deporting immigrants who are in the U.S. illegal, if you're looking at kind of the what's gone on in the last couple of weeks in the Congress, 45% of Democrats said that that was a low priority or not a priority. 6% didn't know. That's 51 total. What does that mean? 49% of Democrats said that deporting undocumented immigrants should be a medium priority, a high priority, or a very high priority.
Right.
And so there's a little bit of a trickiness here. And I think that also applies, though, on the other side. I think it's really easy to look at and say, well, if Trump just follows through on a couple things, but when you look at those concerns about the economy piece, I mean, what's notable, and again, you know, Darren, you know, very rightly included the national debt and the federal budget deficit on this sort of large battery of potential economic concerns. But when we look at the share of Republicans who are very concerned about each, and you look at the federal budget deficit, the national debt, the cost of housing, and the price of gasoline, they're statistically indistinguishable from each other when you talk about the share of Republicans who are very concerned about it.
Yeah.
And with that, you know, it says to me, it's like, you know, I mean, the point is like, well, can we just throw money at it? Well, not if we're concerned about the debt and the deficit. So that's off the table, right? And so part of it is figuring out, you know, even in the sense, you know, people want things, and usually things cost money. But there's also that clear concern about the underlying, you know, financial standing of the country. And it's equally there with these other things that everyone is talking about. Like, oh, it's got to be, you know, you got to do something about housing. It's like, well, is it going to increase the budget deficit? Is it going to increase the debt? Because that's going to create a lot of problems to getting to a deal.
You're right. I think, you know, just not to veer too far off into policy, and particularly economic policy, but, you know, the panacea for all these things is, according to the Trump people, is regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Like they see this as a supply issue, whether it's housing, whether it's labor, it's a supply issue, and the supply is strangled by regulation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to say that with an eye roll. I think there's some truth to that.
That's the argument.
Right. That's the argument.
I think you could probably find that phrase without looking too hard from a Trump nominee.
Right. And that's the you talk about a heavy meal. I would, let's keep with the heavy thing. That's a heavy lift you're putting on deregulation, right?
Yeah.
To increase basically the, incentive structure and the opportunity for increases in supply, which presumably will bring down prices and increase. And we'll see. We'll see. It's there's a theory of the case.
Again, not to get into some kind of policy discussion, but, it's an interesting test of abstract theories when you look at the underlying tensions in these responses, which, are kind of remarkable in the degree to which they track with what the administration is talking about.
Yeah. I tell you, in addition to regulation, though, there is, what we do is we talk about voter psychology. And we emphasize voter psychology, but this is, sort of Americans or Texans psychology too. And the question that's really interesting is there going to be, the evaluations in a lot of sense have been frozen for a while because each side has said like, well, I can't tell you how I think the future is going to go because I don't know who's going to win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we have a winner now. And so what's interesting in the data, which we can talk about, is that one side has been freed up, their unbridled optimism is kind of showing here. And while we could talk about partisan polarization and the differences, but if, 60% of the country, Republicans and some independents and some Democrats think things are good and they think the economy is going to be good, there's a little potential for self-fulfilling prophecy here. And I'll be interested. So there's sort of regulation plus consumer confidence that
I'm
Trump's banking heavily on.
I totally agree with you on a lot of that because, I think there is, again, we see too much in the data, sort of the way that, we're already starting to see it. We haven't seen it just yet, but I think once we do our next poll in February and certainly by April, you're going to see the economic evaluation numbers have flipped by party. So it's sort of easy to kind of like, sort of say, well, what do we do with this, right? But the other part of it, I think that, that you raise that I think is interesting about all this is sort of twofold is one, I think that the challenge here is because it's prices and not jobs, it's not just a supply thing. And and you talk to people and you talk to Democrats sort of as sour grapes after the election, quote unquote, figure out what happened. And I was having a conversation with, a Democrat of, relative prominence, I guess, not too long ago. And we're talking about prices and this person said to me, well, and I've heard this from a lot of Democrats, like, well, when are people going to get used to higher prices? And it's like, how about when their incomes go up? Like, or are the prices kind of, like, is there not, and it's sort of like Democrats are still trying to figure this out. So just to make the point that like, I do think it's possible that, we're going to see a big shift in, sort of economic sentiment now that, putting this quote together, the long national nightmare of the Biden administration is over and the strangling of the economy and all the things that he must have done to ruin people's lives. At the same time, if gas prices are still high, if grocery prices are still high, what are you going to tell people? And I think there's a little bit of that, like kind of all throughout the poll. And you see this in a lot of politics. You see this with the tariffs too, which is like, you can't really like, it's an old phrase, but you piss on someone and tell them it's raining. People didn't really vote for tariffs. Like, that's what the data tells you. So if that's the thing you want to implement on day one, it's like, well, that's like a decision that's being made, but it's not what people are talking about. They're talking about these things. And I wonder how much a shift in the administration is really going to push people if they really do feel like prices are too high or they do really feel like they don't have economic opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, in some sense, the limited toolkit of the president to actually affect the economy might actually help the president here. In other words,
well, he's already walking away from prices.
Trump's will do some different things. Elections have consequences, as everybody keeps saying. But fighting inflation is tough. However, I do think, and this is sort of a naive perspective probably, but I do think, you know, consumer psychology really matters. And if people just think Trump is better at managing the economy is going to be better, the investment and the growth sort of occurs irrespective of specific policies that are being proposed. And I'm not saying that, you know, economics is solely about psychology and not about policy, but I do think sometimes we overrate the toolkit of the president. And I sometimes think we underrate psychology. And you know, this, by the way, the outgoing administration, I think, would probably agree some of this, that there's this irrational pessimism about the American economy.
Well, there's a degree of motivated reasoning in some of this, I think, from a partisan perspective.
Right. Although Democrats also have pretty...
Well, right. I mean, I'm going to come to you in a second, Josh. I mean, one of the interesting things about, like, this conversation we're having, and this is, you know, kind of a simple point, but I kind of want to make it just from 30,000 feet, the idea that when I look at all these, that these were the two buckets of results we're talking about, I'm pretty struck. Maybe I've done too many talks recently, as I know both of you have, about, you know, is polling broken or not or whatever. But, you know, how familiar this all is and how much continuity these attitudes show from what we saw in the election environment and in the outcome of the election. It doesn't get the Trump administration off the hook for having to perform, but what that performance looks like, I think, is, you know, I mean, he's, you know, they are as at the mercy of conditions as the Biden administration was and as the first Trump administration was.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, I agree with what you're saying. I think the one caveat I would make is, you know, it's not even so much like, you know, voter psychology or consumer psychology, but where you do see a difference probably is in the psychology and the approach of CEOs. And that's been going on all over the place right now. So if the sense is that, you know, okay, you know, Washington is more, you know, open, less, there's going to be less oversight. There's going to be more openness to more, you know, yes, more approaches to the economy that are beneficial. Yeah, then they're going to invest more. They're going to do more stuff. Like, that makes sense. And that could accrue, you know, benefit to workers. But the thing is, people aren't saying they're worried about finding jobs. Right. You know, they're still worried about prices. And part of that also is, like, some of that also has to do with international supply chains, all this other stuff. And I think, you know, this just comes down to the fact that what we'll be doing always, and this was sort of the first Trump administration question, was, is there a point at which this matters? You know, we saw inflation ticking up a little bit, you know, in the terms of the last numbers. You know, if prices don't start to come down, if we don't see good economic numbers, and one thing that people don't care about is how the stock market is doing. So outside of the stock market going up, which is that sort of future sense, right? And again, in terms of the people who have a sense that we're saying right now, okay, what do I think is going to happen? Yeah, there's optimism because of these ideas that, you know, again, maybe the government takes its hands off the wheel a little bit more, and that all makes sense. I think that's all very reasonable. But does that apply to the normal voters who, I think, you know, probably affected the margins in the way they did in the last
election?
Well,
I think, Darren, you really put your finger on something interesting to me that I think, you know, really is the core of how is this going to shake out, right? And that is, you know, something that we are very familiar with from the polling, from what we've seen in politics, is that up to a point, you know, there is a, you know, there's, you know, a pretty significant degree to which people's predispositions, their psychology, their partisanship inflects their views of the economy. Right. Now, that we saw the limit case of that for Biden, right? Yeah. With Biden. What is that going to look like here? I mean, look, we've spent the last 2 years talking about the price of eggs, and the price of eggs still pretty high. Somebody went and bought some eggs the other day, and I didn't really notice that much, but there's been so much. I was like, yeah, you know, people are right.
Yeah. These,
you know, $6 for this package of eggs is a little much.
Was it on Morning Joe where Joe Scarborough was saying, like, you know, people are mad because it's like $4 for butter, and Mika Brzezinski says it's $8. And,
yeah.
And he turns to her. I actually think this was a genuine moment. He turns to her and goes, $8? What are they made of, gold? And it was really revealing because
Mika probably buys that fancy Irish butter.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Butter. But it was such that little exchange was so interesting because he meant to make a point about almost to kind of minimize the, you know, Americans being soft.
Yeah.
And, you know, come on, $4. But then when he was actually kind of,
he had the same response everyone else's.
Yeah, the response every American consumer
has. And that price of eggs is twice what it was a year ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
And that is, you know, still, you know, and the sensitivity of that is present throughout
the poll.
Every time we ask people about the economy in this poll and they have a chance to differentiate,
Yeah.
Prices are huge.
And, right? You know, it's there was a nice analysis done by a Democratic consultant that kind of made its way into the hands of the media and had a nice little run in October, kind of trotting out Democratic ideas or messaging on the economy. And I remember the macro heading was, you know, you deluded ungrateful wretches.
Yeah, right.
And it was the point of the chart, I remember, was to say that, you know, this probably isn't great messaging.
Right.
But, it, you know, comic kind of, you know, chops aside, that sort of was the Democratic messaging. And in fact, even in Biden's farewell address, there was this sort of, you know, and obviously there are data that support that interpretation. And there's classic, you know, our economy is the envy of the world,
right.
Which I think intellectually we all understand. But
what good does that do me when I'm in the grocery line?
Exactly. You know? I do. I just recoil at, you know, the take on politics and the take on the election, you know, that minimized, mm-hmm. you know, the legitimacy of that reaction. Because, I mean, you know, we've talked about this in many instances, you know, telling the public they're dumb for having the reaction they have is never, first of all, it's usually wrong.
Or that they're wrong. Or that they're wrong in believing what they believe.
Right.
So the question, you know, but that, you know, that places us right where I started, right? Which is, that's going to apply to Donald Trump too, I think.
Yeah.
Even Donald Trump is singular and idiosyncratic and all these other things about him.
Yeah. And Jim, I apologize. Yeah, I apologize earlier because I was focusing on and sort of took the conversation in the wrong direction in some ways on the big macros, the most important, the top priorities. Yeah. But Josh was referring and Jim was sort of teeing this up for a more particular reaction to the economic priorities. And I do think that that's, you know, those data in here are really pretty fascinating. And the partisan divide, there's a consensus that, you know, even Democrats think, you know, inflation, price are a big deal. But when you start breaking it down beyond that, you really do see interesting partisan differences.
Right.
And as Jim, as you were pointing out, Republicans want a lot of different, almost contradictory things. And then Democrats want other things within this basket of the economy. So, you know, as Josh was pointing out, we talked about the cost of healthcare, housing, gasoline, the debt, the deficit. And, you know, you really see, first of all, most everything matters, or we're concerned about most everything, but variation is really coincident with party. You know, Democrats are concerned. And, but by the way, you see some of these, you know, you see some of these potential advantages for the Democrats in these smaller bore ideas. So, you know, like the cost of healthcare, the cost of housing. These are, if these rise to the fore, Jim, to your point, if prices, even if prices sort of stay where they are, but if these other things become acute, and I can't help but thinking about, you know, Jim and I have ties to Los Angeles, and think about the wildfires, and, you know, I've had family try to find apartment space in Los Angeles even 5 years ago, and it was almost impossible. I can't imagine what it's going to be like now, and that's an acute example, but look at Austin, and look at the price of housing and all. I could see these other issues being kind of the new frontier and a place where, if Trump isn't on top of these things, and if they rise to the fore, he's just going to have the same kind of broad economic issues Biden did, just under a different.
Well, that's what I wonder, right? Yeah. I mean, these are
they're big systemic issues. I mean, when you look at this list, I mean, one of the interesting things I think, you know, there's two things I'll just draw from this, which is to say, you know, most of the inflation over the last, you know, really any period of time, you pick it, it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't really matter. So even going beyond the sort of recent period is driven primarily by housing, healthcare, and education. I mean, if you look at, like, consumer goods have actually been relatively steady for a long period of time until this recent uptick, which is sort of what people are noticing. But I also would point out that, like, people are also noticing because, like, if your rent goes up $300 a month, then the available funds to spend, you know, on this other stuff that's now also significantly more expensive is also much less. I'd also add, just to throw it out there, cost of housing also includes insurance, which is becoming almost nearly impossible, speaking of LA, and I mean places like Austin too. I mean, there's sort of like a standing kind of cliff out there. I'm sorry, I lost my train.
Yeah, that's
sorry,
fine.
I
mean, look, I think we've sort of arrived at, I mean, to me, that's the looming question.
Yeah.
Right? That is highlighted by what we see in the data, right? That there are these underlying tensions in the agenda, and we, you know, and we have a lot of
We know that this did not work out very well for the last guy.
I remember. Can I come in for tension?
Yeah, sure. The train is back.
Yeah, the train is back. No, I was thinking, you know, I mean, all this talk about, you know, is it inflation or is it prices? And in some ways, it doesn't matter because of how voters don't really respond to it differently. But from a policy standpoint, it is kind of different, right? We know that, like, inflation is relatively cool. But if inflation is the problem, in some ways, the goal is to pull the government back and pull it out of it. You know, right? That is, we want less investment. We don't want to start sending checks out to everybody. We don't want huge tax cuts because we don't want to increase inflation. If the problem is prices and cost of living, that might point to a different set of solutions that might require more government to do something, whether regulatory or otherwise, to address those prices. The issue here right now is that, you know, when you tie those things together with the concern about the debt and the deficit, it really ties the hands, I think, of whoever's in power right now, because it is people want you to do something. They don't want you to drive inflation. And also the ruling party doesn't want to see you increase the debt or deficit. So what can you actually do? And then you're left with, like, well, let's shrink the size of government. We've got, you know, and everybody talks about, you know, fraud, waste, abuse, and how much is that going to really accrue to, like, actual savings? Well, and it's usually very little.
I think Musk and Ramaswamy are already coming off some of their initial estimates about what Doge might accomplish.
Because, you know, they were going to have to.
Yeah.
It was almost always going to be the case. It's just an administration coming in, or a led session, you know, firing things up in Austin. You know, there's always questions about what to tackle. I was struck, though, to return to my original point, that at the national level, the American public's pretty clear. And I think the election was pretty clear on what they'd want Trump to do. But as we were saying, the inflation part is the trickiest part of it. I do think there's the potential for a deal on some things. I'm interested in, at the national level, Fetterman and Warren and others basically signaling to Trump that if you want a bipartisan deal, so just for instance, this is, I have no inside knowledge, but this is speculation. Yeah. You know, take the tax cuts, which are set to expire this next year. You know, the tax cuts, the tax rates were cut in 2017, right? 2017, for every level except, I think it was $200,000 to like $600,000. That rate stayed the same. What if you just said, okay, let's renew everything except the $600,000 and up tax rate, which I think went from 39% to 37% or something like that, right?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly, but something like that.
Could you get a deal by basically saying, like, okay, we're going to renew the tax cuts, except not for the rich?
Yeah.
Which actually would, one, have bipartisan support, I'll bet, and two, would kind of address the revenue issue, right? Because the tax cuts are in place, right? So what you're talking about then is actually recouping. In other words, I think this sort of populism of Trump's appeal could create opportunities for, you know, unique solutions. But that's, again, if he's looking for them. And
yeah, I mean, that was my main question for you. I mean, I think the thing that I kind of come to, you know, going to the second term is, you know, how willing is Trump to make a deal? Yeah. I mean, I think that's sort of been the interesting thing about this whole deal maker persona and everything else, because I haven't seen many deals.
Well, and with who, and who's ready to make a deal, particularly in the House.
I would say, even if you make a deal in the Senate.
Well, it's ironic that we know from the literature on the presidency that, you know, presidents tend to gravitate towards foreign policy late in their terms, or certainly in their second terms, because they have more latitude, because they can make deals, you know, and because domestic politics is less pressing when it comes to that. So I'm kind of interested in the potential for, you know, deals in the Middle East, continuation of things like the Abrams Accords, the potential for a deal in Ukraine, et cetera. These are really kind of interesting. Domestically, it will be tricky. I do think one thing that's clear in the data is, and this will be an interesting test of, you know, the Trump personality. You know what there's no appetite for is pursuing political vendettas and lawfare and, you know, people, even Republicans. So I it's interesting. I had this conversation with a friend of mine here at UT who's extremely concerned about Trump sort of pressing these things against Liz Cheney and other people. And his point was that, well, you have to pay off your constituents who want scalps. I don't think that's necessary at all. Now, if he wants to do that, that's a reflection of his personality, I think. But the data suggests that you know what Republicans aren't saying is a high priority? Going after Liz Cheney or Jack Smith or, it's just not in the data. Mm-hmm. The priorities here, again, circling way back, are pretty obvious. Help me with, you know, help me on affordability, control the southern border, you know, relatedly stop the fentanyl spread. And interestingly, we might want to talk about this later. This might be one of my sort of bullet points at the end. Strengthen national defense.
Yeah.
Even the
isolation. Very odd. I thought that was an odd response given
some of the other responses. Yeah, I'm glad we put it in, and I think Josh might have, or Eugene might have insisted on it. But it's a, I think it's a sleeper issue if the administration is actually looking to build a record of accomplishment. Because I do think there's real potential for bipartisan. You know, there is obviously an isolationist sentiment of don't commit American treasure resources, but there's also part of that mentality is we're spread too thin. You know, we need to have a really Haig's phrase, a lethal fighting force.
Democrats
don't want to look soft.
And as a Republican, I mean, you can be pro national defense but not interventionist.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
There's a certain, you know,
I think that's a way, you know, we're talking
traditional
about
traditional nationalism, the Republican Party, right, that has looked like that over time.
Yeah. I guess what we're sort of searching for here is
those are your spoils, right?
Yeah.
And the spoil, you know, instead of scalps, those are the spoils, right? I mean, how do you want to send a bunch of economic aid to a bunch of different, you know, either both high level, low, mid, and just spread it out.
Yeah.
Increase the fighting force.
Yeah. You know. And I think we're looking at, you know, and all of us here, you know, in this room certainly, but more broadly, are trying to figure out what is this coalition, what is this new Republican Party about? And so I look at the data that we're bringing and trying to find areas where you might be able to, you know, you might be able to square this circle or.
Well, you know, for once you mentioned populism before I did. But when you raised it, I mean, I think that's part of, that's one of the interesting things that is just bubbling under here. Like,
oh yeah,
what is this contemporary form of populism that now has a home in the Republican Party?
Yeah, I think it's the question.
You know,
I wonder.
And how does it coexist with traditional Republican priorities? And that's why I was talking about deficits. You know, your inclusion of deficits and the debt, because there are obviously still elected officials at the, you know, elite or cadre level that are still obviously, you know, we're sitting here in Texas. You know, Chip Roy's not going to let that go.
Right.
You know, at least not for free.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's interesting. We'll get to these numbers probably here in just a minute, but there's this increase in evaluations, favorability of some institutions as well as some, you know, elites. And some of that is that, you know, we have the resolution of the election. So Republicans are more likely to say we're favorable towards institutions that are now going to be clearly under Republican control. Mm-hmm. So that's a big part of it. But there's an interesting question, right? Which is Trump comes to power as you know, consistent with, you know, the appeal of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and others criticizing the system. But Warren's quote the other day, Senator Warren's quote was, if, you know, Trump wants my help to unrig the system, I'm there for him.
Yeah.
Right?
If he really means it.
Right. If he means it.
From my point of view.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So this is interesting, right? That now you are in charge of the entity that has attracted all this antipathy. And, you know, Doge is sort of an interesting, you know, we kind of laughed a little bit, but it's a serious, how do you govern when you're, to the extent you have a mandate, it's to, you know, reform governance.
So I want to pivot from this before we get to the end. We got to get you to class on time. So I want to talk for just a second. I have a question for both of you, but because you're not always here, Darren. Or for all of us, really. You know, I want to look at the priority items. You know, we asked an open-ended question, asking our respondents what they thought the legislature's top priority should be. Would you tell us what we got from that? And I just want to preface this. The reason I want to pivot hard to this is that this is one of the areas where I thought the prevalence of the issues that define the national election, not surprisingly, have really carried through even when we point respondents to the legislature to some degree.
Yeah. So we asked them an open-ended question. What's sort of the one priority that you think the legislature should definitely be focused on here in 2025. So obviously, you know, no one issue dominates when people can say anything, but the issue that came up most frequently, unsurprisingly, was immigration, the border, which is 22% of all voters, but 37% of Republican voters, which was clearly the plurality. So 22% of voters said immigration or the border, 16% said the economy or prices, and 8% said something about public education is sort of the three biggest issues. For Democrats, it was the economy and prices, 18%, public education at 11%. And to be clear, they're open-ended. That was not pro-voucher comments. Those were very clearly, you know.
And that was a little less than 1% and about 2% of Republicans.
About 2% of Republicans mentioned vouchers. in a positive way. And then for Republicans, 37% said immigration to the border, which should not surprise us at all or anyone who's listened to this podcast. 14% said the economy or prices. And then there was a pretty big spread after that across other things, which again points to this fact that these driving issues are still the driving issues.
Right. And then to our previous point about the mood for spending and what is going on, when we ask people about state spending in a question, you know, these are not completely unfamiliar responses, but they were interesting in terms of what the top three or four items were in which people said the state was still spending too little.
Right. So overall, so I think we asked about 12 different policy areas, whether the state was spending too much, about the right amount, or too little. Only three areas saw a majority of voters saying the state spends too little. That was mental health services, 58%, healthcare, 55%, same area. And electric infrastructure is still a sore spot, 50%, very close to majority, 49% each, K-12 public education, and children in the state's care. But it's important to note here that only one issue saw a majority of Republicans saying the state was spending too little, and that was border security. Mental health services was 49%, electric infrastructure was 45%, healthcare 42%, and everything else was below 40% of Republicans saying the state was spending too little. Remember, this is the majority party's voters. And so even though, you know, this sort of clear concern about both, let's set the border aside, but clear concern about the economy is everywhere in the poll, it's not as though you see Texas Republican voters, majority party voters, looking at the government and saying, hey, you guys need to start investing in this stuff, or hey, we need more in, you know, really any number of areas except for border security, where you see consistent and continued support for increased spending.
But electric infrastructure was pretty high.
Electric infrastructure remains high.
Well, I thought, you know, the top item was mental health services. And I can't help but wonder if the school shootings—
It was the top item last time.
Yeah. You know, but I don't mean that.
I don't completely agree with that.
I think this is, you know, I wonder if it's, you know, Uncle Joe, you know, is struggling with, you know, his situation. That's something that Texans think we ought to, or it's younger people, vulnerable populations, and the potential for violence.
Yeah.
I really believe it's.
Well, and look, we, you know, if you go back to the aftermath of some of the school shootings, we've seen a lot of kind of consensus movement in public opinion when you ask people about either causes or remedies.
Yeah.
Mental health is the safe harbor to avoid the imbroglio of talking about guns.
I'd also say that mental health has come up in other domains now, too. So it's also school shootings, but it gets talked about a lot in terms of homelessness.
Yeah.
And so to the extent veterans, that homelessness and veterans and suicide. And so there's just, you know, I think that the issue of mental health has become one that comes up in a bunch of different policy domains. And it's very easy for people to say, like, you know, I mean, I say from other polling that I've done, I want to say maybe the Lyceum polling we've done, you know, we ask people about access. I mean, there's really major uneven distribution of access to mental health services, depending on whether you live in urban, suburban, or rural communities, your education level. So I think all that stuff has really, you know, just become, it's easy to say we should be doing more.
And I think it's, you know, my standard caveat to this question is, you know, people tend to want to spend money to solve problems. So there's a little bit of, and
there's, know, there's an inflationary force
right,
in
exactly.
this question.
Because, you know, saying I want to spend more money is a marker for I think this is a serious problem. Mm-hmm. However, you know, even in other contexts, we didn't do this here, but in other contexts, we'll ask, like, even if, you know, would you like to spend more or less or about the same, even if it means higher taxes? And you still get very high percentages saying, you know, I still think we should be spending more on this issue. So, so I just wanted people who are looking at the results should know that this isn't, you know, people's willingness to say they want to spend more money is not simply a function of, you know, kind of the inflated tendency
being profligate.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Or just to show how much you care about the issue. It's, you know, even with provisos, people say, like, no, we should spend more money. I also think the variance across the issues really is interesting. You know, the distinction between K-12 versus versus higher ed is important. You also see on the too much side, whenever there's sort of a partisan divide, you know, if the issue is a little bit partisan, that's where you'll see the too much number popping up. So 17% said there's too much spending on border security, 15% too much spending on environmental protection, you know, 19% too much on prisons and the penal system. So, you know, That's a marker. Well,
on the flip side, you know, of the 12 issues we tested, in 8 of them, a majority of Democrats said the state was spending too little.
Yeah.
And so some of that is realistic and some of that is also just, you know, disappointment. And I think the healthcare numbers being at the top, and part, I mean, again, it is partially the school shootings. It's also the fact that, you know, Texas remains, you know, the state with the highest share of uninsured adults in the country. It's twice, I think, the national average. So, I mean, it's just likely, given that 1 in 5 Texans probably doesn't have health insurance.
There are some cartons of eggs.
Yeah,
in here.
It's just out there, you know. Just like the border being right there kind of affects the salience of the issue.
The reason I kind of pivoted us that way, because, I mean, to me, it remains interesting the degree to which you see the combination here of the national political environment in the concerns, you know, immigration, economy, prices. And then the issues that we think of is really have been active, whether because of public or elite concerns, one can open, you know, one can debate that. You know, public education drops down to 8.
Yeah.
You know, the spending on K-12 education, as you pointed out, Josh, 49% too little, 29% right amount, 10% too much. You know, that's a much more homegrown issue in terms of the dynamics in the state right now. And it's interesting to me to watch, you know, what is bubbling up and what is emanating down, right? And how those two are colliding at the state level as we go into the session. And, you know, you were pointing this out as we were doing the write-up yesterday, Josh, where, you know, the state has some money to spend, but we're not as flush as we look given what the demands are.
Mm-hmm.
And we still see a lot of, you know, pretty high measures of spending too little, not at the high end, but, you know, water infrastructure, 44%.
Which that's one of those where the elites are really trying to push that to get that message out right now because they want to spend money on water.
Yeah. And I think there's an interesting, you know, the ongoing struggle of the last few sessions as the, you know, as you've seen these ideological fights inside the Republican Party that is so dominant in the state. The fights between Republicans and Democrats and how that is all coming to a head in this as we go into, you know, an election year in 2026. Very interesting to me. All right. So let's go before we run out of time. I want to do our usual lightning round. Whatever we've done, you know, what we talked about, what else sticks out that you want to flag while we have a few minutes? Darren?
Well, we had there's one for you and one for us approach to polling sometimes, with one for you being
particularly
our,
in December.
Our public, our audience, our clientele being the you. But the one for us was a series of questions, fave, unfave ratings on Texans, a bunch of homegrown Texans. So
crappy emails. Some Texan born,
some are transplants, some like Joe
Texans
Rogan.
They've got an association, a strong
association
of
choice.
Right.
Yes.
I moved here too.
Yeah,
and so did
that's
you.
That's right. So, and this is everyone from pop internet. So Willie Nelson is on the list. Selena Gomez, Beyonce, who has, you know, appropriately high, you know, favorability ratings. But I was struck as a sports fan by our dear, you know, Jerry Jones, owner of the late
great bum steer of the year,
Dallas Cowboys. Yeah,
Texas Monthly's bum steer of the year.
Right.
As it turns out.
You know, almost all these people, you know, have tremendous favorability ratings, you know, Willie Nelson, Matthew McConaughey, Simone Biles, even Elon Musk is plus 24,
yeah,
fave, unfave. Nolan Ryan, who's also near and dear to my heart, you know, 48 favorable, 3% unfavorable, and shame on the 3% who rate Nolan Ryan unfavorably. But on the negative side, I believe, Josh, correct me on this, I believe the only person in underwater on our entire list is Jerry Jones, who's 24 fave, 28 unfave, and including on the very unfavorable, 14 very unfavorable, only 6 very favorable. It's tough. It's tough. And perhaps part of the reason that, or at least kind of speaks to why the bum steer award by Texas Monthly went to Jerry this year. Conversely, just on the sports side, Greg Popovich, still, you know, plus 18 fave, unfave, coach, legendary coach of the Spurs. So that caught
legendary and politically outspoken.
That's right. Politically outspoken. And 33% don't know who Greg Popovich is. I should not be surprised by this, but within Texas, I was a little surprised.
Well, the Jerry Jones, you know,
yeah,
people with a fixed opinion of Jerry Jones is even lower.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And Jerry Jones was,
And Josh is laughing at me. This guy came in. You know, Jerry Jones made a cameo on Landman.
I know. And I heard, which I heard was very good. But yeah.
Well, I think reasonable people might disagree
okay.
about that.
Okay.
He was, you know, I'll
tell
you this.
I heard he was acting chops.
He was better than I thought, but I'll put it this way. The scripting of his scene was on a line with the rest of that show.
All right. I got you. Okay.
Josh, how about you? Cultural criticism.
I was going to say, that's another pod.
Sorry. You know, we could talk about those alone. But anyway, yeah, you know, I think in a continued effort to uncover the evolving sort of state of, you know, relevant abortion attitudes here in Texas, we did a little bit of a survey experiment where we presented half of our subjects with one version of a question and half of our respondents with another version of the question. So therefore, we know that the difference is just related to the question wording. And so what we asked was, in one question, do you believe, yes or no, that human life begins at conception? And then in the other version of the question, we asked whether constitutional rights and protections begin at conception. The idea here is to get to this, you know, sort of suss out this, whether there's a difference that people want to make between when human life starts versus when we're going to start, you know, sort of extending rights to that human life. So what we found was 56% of Texans said, yes, human life begins at conception. That drops to 39%, so 17-point drop when we switch that to constitutional rights and protections. Among Democrats, you see an 11-point drop, which is not surprising that it's less because they started at a lower baseline. 39% said, yes, human life begins at conception. 28% said the same thing for constitutional rights and protections. For Republicans, the drop was 18 points from 71% who said human life begins at conception compared to 53% who said that constitutional rights and protections begin at conception. Where most of that movement went was to the don't know. So the don't know doubled from 16% among Republicans to 30%. The biggest movement was among independents. Shocker. 47% said human life begins at conception. Only 19% said that constitutional rights begin at conception. That was a 28-point drop. So that's something we're going to, you know, mess around with. I think.
Well, you know, I was really glad we split that sample on that because we've talked about how to ask that question a lot internally. And Josh and I, as we were, you know, doing that draft, you know, kind of kicking it around, it's kind of like, you know, let's just find out. It's the, you know, again, this was kind of a split between one for everybody else, but also one for us. The December poll is where we're more likely to kind of do things like this. And
yeah, yeah. Just to put like just the slightest bit of interpretation on, I mean, I think what you got to understand here is that, yeah, you know, to the extent that there is a majority of Texans say, yes, human life begins at conception when, you know, when embryo is created, when sperm hits egg, that is when human life begins. But it's important to note, and what this sort of uncovers is that doesn't equal this is a fully formed person who gets legal rights and all that stuff in everybody's mind.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the next step with some of the stuff that we're trying to just, you know, get a little baseline sense.
There's really a lot to think about.
A lot to think about.
It speaks to our kind of larger project on abortion, which is, you know, teasing or sussing out the complexity of circumstance and timing. And I actually like this project in the sense that, you know, the American public is trying, a Texas public is trying to do the best they can on these issues with competing interests.
Yeah.
And I think that's reasonable and, you know, worth documenting and kind of gauging how compelling some circumstances or timing issues are compared to others is that's something that we can contribute to the conversation if we can kind of give information on that.
All right. For myself, I want to go back. I am going to give myself again point of privilege and take two sort of. I want to piggyback on Darren's point about Elon Musk, and we all kind of wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, the public figure
ratings. We make Josh do issues.
We've been talking about the public doing something like this
for quite a while,
and we finally. And look, you know, the figures on that list. We got a lot of good variants on that list. You know, the original motivation, not surprising, is for us, but is more within the mission, which, you know, I've been long interested in. You know, a few years ago, people were talking about Matthew McConaughey running for governor. Now Elon Musk has now become the kind of edge case that really pushed us into finally doing it, to my mind, in a way. And it was interesting to me that if you look at those internals on Elon Musk, just how quickly. And it's not totally understandable, but just how quickly the partisan structure has formed in the attitude towards him. I mean, the Republican, you know, favorable ratings are like 80% or something, I think, or right in that neighborhood. Democrats much lower. And it really reminds me to go back to our pop culture podcast today. And this is something you pointed out to me before I watched the documentary, Josh, and that is the scene in the Taylor Swift documentary in which she's talking about endorsing against Martha Blackburn. And you can see her financial advisors, I think including her dad, are sitting there going,
yeah,
Well, you can do what you want, but you're kind of going to alienate half your audience no matter what you do. And that happened so fast with Elon Musk. Now, I think there was probably already some leaning going that, but his closeness to Trump, he's cratered among Democrats, right, in an interesting way. The other thing is actually something you flagged earlier in the podcast, but, you know, we did our institutional ratings, institutional organizational ratings, where we ask people, and I was interested in the four that were net negative. In other words, a lot of the institutions, and again, this December poll, were edged into net, you know, stayed in net favorable, territory, some much more than others. But the four that were net negative, the criminal justice system, the federal government, the news media, and major corporations based on outside the United States. And to me, that raises questions we won't be able to plumb here about this, like what is going on with this anti-institutional impulse? Where does it really cohere? What's going to happen with the Doge thing or whatever we're supposed to call that, Doge? That is the, you know, the fundamental effort to kind of reduce the size of the federal government, but also then the fundamental changes in the media environment, which we've not really talked about when the three of us have been together. But when you look at the way the media environment shaped this election, which is also one of the things that kind of did run underneath the surface of our public figure thing by asking about Joe Rogan, including Joe Rogan on that list. But if you start, if you're following the media business right now, this election was a watershed that we paid a lot of attention to, the social media, the podcast election and all of that. But, you know, the news media, the structure of the news media is completely changed and is not going back. And I think we, in some ways, that's such a mundane observation. We've all watched cable. But I mean, the cable industry is right now, the companies that own the major cable outlets are having a fire sale. I mean, they're basically divesting themselves, and that market is kind of done, and that outlet is really pretty done. And I think the negative ratings of the news media really made me think about the degree to which, you know, people are just getting their political information in very different ways than when we started doing this, really all three of us, you know, let alone the older ones among us.
I think that really dovetails with what Darren was talking about earlier and what we were talking about here about, you know, thinking about handicapping the Trump administration is going to be a large, to a large extent about how people feel about the economy. I mean, just kind of, not to be too simple, but to the extent that, like, what was the last election about? It's kind of about the economy. I mean, like, that's what everybody kept telling us.
Yeah.
We can make it more complicated, but, like, that was what it was for a lot of people. And it does make me wonder, you know, okay, the economy, technically, there are numbers that we can all look to, but if we're all getting information, you know, this totally, like, how is this going
to
shape out?
Right, because look, when you're in the supermarket, to go back to our earlier conversation, look, picking up a dozen eggs and going, man, prices, Biden inflation, you know, that used to be you competed with what you were hearing when, you know, more or less you went home and listened to the monocultural media outlets, like your 5 o'clock local news, the 6 o'clock national news. Now, I don't know what, there's a million other things competing with that. And, you know, the lack of trust in the national, in the news media, when we put it that way, such as it previously existed, is going to be a huge factor in that. Trump has proven adept at that, but at managing that and part of that, but
We need to let Darren go, but I was going to say, but part of that also is the fact that that, it, you know, the monolith, the opposite of the monolith is not just that it's fractured, but that it's served up. So I'm finding you because you are a Republican voter when I'm trying to message you on this. I'm trying to get you to this source of information. I'm finding Democratic voters. I'm finding – and that's the thing about it that's really
– And yet, a really interesting thing. I mean, you mentioned the fires in L.A., Darren, and one of the – I was listening to one of the media podcasts at Puck the other day. I mean, these couple of guys on the podcast were based in L.A. And just, you know, also a discussion of – was part of the critique of how city government communicated, but they're also saying, but the numbers of the viewership of the local newscast just skyrocketed.
Yep. Yeah.
So when everything went to kind of hell,
right,
people went, well, I'm going to turn on, you know, KTLA or Eyewitness News. Or
we actually did. We checked in. But real quickly, you know, just a couple of scattered observations. Local news is the exception to the media you know, to the local general
TV news.
Yeah, yeah. To the general storyline about the decline of legacy or mainstream. That's and politicians know that. You talk to the Abbott people, you talk to people at the national level, they understand that. They still care about
local media,
what's going on in Lubbock and what's going on in Laredo and et cetera. The second observation would be the exception to the legacy media is irrelevant is a big exception in 2024, and that is chasing Joe Biden out of the race. The formation of a consensus in these legacy media, especially, you know, cable carriers, MSNBC, CNN, et cetera, that debate, you know, was disastrous. And the conversation that flowed from that on social media and elsewhere, you know, we always have this question about, you know, is the tail wagging the dog or a question of causality, what's driving what? We saw that in real time. I was watching, you know, Democratic-leaning cable stations immediately, and they weren't responding to social media. They were saying this
thing
was
itself. Yeah. They were looking at the eggs.
So it's interesting. It's right. Part of this, and I agree with the larger narrative about the just irrelevance in many ways of the legacy media in modern politics. But boy, that's a big outlier.
Yeah, they're dying, but they're not dead. And
right,
you know.
Right. And who knows? You know, if they're gone, would that have happened? And it was probably. But boy, the push and the effect on the left, you know, the counterfactual would be if they had hung in there and said, it wasn't that bad. He had an off night. He was jet lagged. But boy, nobody did that. And if they had, would Democrats have hung with Biden? You know, interesting.
Well, there's an interesting conversation about the object itself and just how much space there was for reinterpretation.
Well, that's the third and final point, which is at what point does, you know, there are people who would argue that, well, what this means is that there is no reality beyond a partisan reality. I beg to differ on that. You look at inflation. You look at Afghanistan, the withdrawal from Afghanistan. You look at the wildfires in Los Angeles. And, you know, who are you going to believe? Who are you going to believe, us or your lying eyes? I think your lying eyes is still a powerful thing.
Yeah.
And so while I agree with every point that we've been making and you know, we'll probably co-author with you guys at some point on these observations, the exceptions or the complications are really interesting.
They tell us something.
They do, absolutely. They do.
Guys, thanks. Super fun, as always. Maybe even a little bit more today. I don't know. Maybe because I haven't seen Darren in a while.
Freed up from the election.
The election.
We're all in good moods.
You know. So thank you guys for being here. Thanks very much to our excellent crew here in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, we'll if you're listening to this on a podcast platform, we did go through a lot of data today. We'll post links to data on our website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu, and we'll put some direct links in the post for the podcast on our blog section so you can go find stuff. So, and with that, thanks again, and we'll be back next week with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.